This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2019, held in Montgomery, Indiana, on March 1 and 2.
Well, good morning and welcome. And I'm Eugene Yoder. I'm from Virginia. Been treasurer or secretary treasurer for about ever since the outreach started 8 years ago or so when we started our school. Prior to that, I taught school for a number of years. And so I don't know if you'd say I've felt both sides of the spectrum or not, but I've been involved a little bit in both sides. Just curious, how many treasurers do we have here that have been treasurers for a number of years, 3 or more years? Okay. How many here that are first-year treasurers? Okay. And the others are in between. As I thought about what the responsibilities of a treasurer are, treasurers should be efficient, accurate, and flexible. Reports should always be available immediately. They should be readable so anyone can understand with minimal effort. You should know what's on every line item and how you designated every expense. There should never be a penalty for late fees or fines. You have 24 hours in the day and, of course, 5 hours of work for yourself, leaving the 19 hours of work to keep the school books and records straight and available. In short, you were divinely appointed and enabled with supernatural energy and abilities. I feel that way sometimes, and I imagine maybe some of the rest of you do too. My goal today is to kind of give you a quick rundown of some of the basic responsibilities, and then I'm hoping to have general discussion. What are your questions? What would you like to hear from other treasurers who are involved in treasurer type of responsibilities, whether it's payroll, whether it's keeping books straight, what kind of record keeping do you do? All of those things. Hopefully we'll have a little time for that. One of the big responsibilities of a treasurer is knowing how to accurately record items. And whether you use a computer to do that or whether you use paper, either one can work. Personally, as an accountant, I keep getting more familiarized with my computer. And computers just do, as long as you enter the information correctly, you can get it out correctly. Now there's where the catch is. If it doesn't go incorrectly, you don't know where it's going to come out at. We tried balancing the books last year, and we were $2,000 off. Couldn't figure out where this $2,000 went to. You know it doesn't look good if you put a beginning balance and an ending balance, and, well, there's $2,000 that we don't know where they went to. People say, really? $2,000, you don't know where it went to. Well, what ended up happening was that we had designated it as a capital asset. Basically, it was a place that I believe that we had put in. So it wasn't showing up on the profit and loss as immediately connected with that year. We were saying, this is something we've invested in the school. It kind of belongs in a different place. And once we put that figure in, we might have been 2 cents off, which still is a problem for an accountant, especially if you're a true accountant that's really concerned about things will spend 10 hours tracking down 1 cent or 2 cents. Now, some of us aren't that detailed. But anyway, you want to keep your books accurate. Keep track of your income. Keep track of your expenses. Something I learned from someone else is on the bills, a lot of times, what he'll end up doing is write down PD, paid, and then put a number there. So you know which check number paid this particular bill. Basically, my goal is to keep a paper trail of everything. Now, most of my records are on my computer. I keep track of them on the computer. But in case someone were to want to know where these expenses came from, what they were documented as, I try to leave a paper trail. You try to put a receipt in the file somewhere. Most likely you won't. You'll never use it. But it is a paper trail there just to verify that you did indeed spend that money on that expense. I don't know if many of you have different account balances or not. If you have a checking account, savings account, one of your responsibilities is to balance those periodically. If it balanced last month and you do it monthly, it's usually not too much a problem. If you wait for several months, it gets to be a challenge. In our particular situation, what's causing us some challenge is that the school and the church have a credit card together, and there are at least two cards. We use our card sometimes as treasurer, and our principal, also the church minister, will use the card. And so we need to keep track of which ones are church expenses, which ones are school expenses. Just requires interaction and saying, okay, was this a school expense? Was it a church expense? What was it for? Trying to keep track of what's in the balances. Accounts payable, if you have a system of billing, it's important to keep track of who paid, how much they paid, and who still needs to pay. Part of the responsibility. Reporting. I find it intriguing, but as an accountant, certain things don't intimidate me possibly like some others. These are two reports showing about the same thing. I don't know if you can, it's just a see. Now the reason I show you this happens to be a QuickBooks report that came out of the computer. My dear board chairman, who's better at a lot of things than I am, he sees this paper and he says, show me a paper I can understand. Now there's not a lot of difference, at least not in my mind. But this is a report and this is a report. This tends to have a little more space on it. So this is something you can understand. And so if your computerized reports just don't make sense to someone, it's your responsibility to come up with something that makes sense. Like I say, to me, they say about the same thing. To him, they don't. And so come up with something that's understandable for anyone in church to read. One of the beauties of having it in a computer is that you can track exactly what that category all was. So if you would ask me for example, landscaping expenses. What was involved in that $700 landscaping expenses? I could soon tell you what was involved in that. But make your reports readable so someone can understand. Integrity. Know who pays what and when they paid it. I already talked about keeping receipts for documents. If you buy things for the school and reimburse yourself, make sure you document that. And I think you all know. And most of us, our churches trust. We trust each other, and that's good. But there have been situations where treasurers have not been honest. It's not above my ability to be dishonest. Just make sure you document well when you're the one spending the school's money and reimbursing yourself. Because in essence, you're spending money and then getting reimbursed. And so, yeah, just document it well. If you're responsible to pay teachers, pay them on time if you can. And if you can't, at least communicate with them why you can't or that it's going to be a little late. Taxes, you need to decide. Most of you probably have it in place. How many of you outsource your payroll, meaning someone else does it for you? Okay. How many of you insource, do it yourselves? Okay, some of the rest of you. I'm not gonna say one way is better than another way. I'm going to say responsibilities that pass from chairman to chairman or from treasurer to treasurer will make it easier if you're outsourcing your payroll. Now, it comes at an expense. I'm not going to advertise too heavily, but I do work for Yoder Financial Services, and we are a company that does provide payroll if you want that. If you're curious about prices, you're looking at about anywhere from $30 a pay period to about $400 a year. And that varies on what kind you would want. We offer basically two different kinds. One is full service payroll. That's where you pay by the pay period. But that includes all record keeping and it includes direct deposit for your teachers. We also work with more of a, basically give you a spreadsheet, you fill in the numbers on the spreadsheet, and then you write the checks out. Basically all that Yoder Financial would do is take care of the government, send the money in to them, or report it to them anyway. Basically you do a lot of the work and then we just do some of the other work. Paying your teachers, you should be withholding tax for your teachers. There's just a handful of schools that I'm aware of yet that pay their teachers with a 1099 form. I discourage that because teachers are employees. You tell them where to go to work, you tell them how to work. They're not self-contractors that decide when they're going to come to work, how they're going to do the job. You are paying them and you are employing them. And so as such, teachers are not, they're not self-employed individuals. Now where it gets a little interesting is when you start talking volunteers and part-time helpers. How do you pay them? In our particular situation, we've kind of taken the stand that if they're helping out for a week or two, just short term, we will just pay them cash oftentimes. Even though probably technically they should be on payroll. It gets to be a lot of work putting someone on payroll. You have to fill out the I-4, the I-9, fill out those paperwork forms if you put them on payroll. So regular teachers should definitely be on payroll. Part-time people, like I say, we've kind of taken the approach, we pay them, just write them out a check and say, yeah, we appreciate your contribution. Something I know that has picked up in recent years is scholarships. Pennsylvania has had a program for years, a school scholarship program. Virginia has had it now for, it's probably been about 5 years. And I'm not familiar with other states if they have scholarship programs as well. Basically what that is, it's just a program. The state says in an effort to try to lower our budget, I guess you'd say, we're trying to move people out of a public school setting into a private school setting. And so students that are schooled in a private school setting, the school actually gets a benefit from that. But it is designed to help parents pay for sending their children to a private school. And so as such, if you're getting scholarship funds, try as much as possible to designate or to show that it is benefiting the parents. It's not just benefiting the school because the scholarship fund is meant to benefit the parents. And so as such, don't just say, well, this is a windfall for the school. We're getting thousands of dollars in. Yeah, it is a blessing to the school, but it is also designed to help the parents. And so if possible in your record keeping, keep track of that. In our particular situation, it gets interesting because this program was implemented, like I said, about 5 years ago. About half of my students are on the scholarship program. The other half are old enough that they weren't on the program. The Virginia Scholarship Program, which is what I'm most familiar with, is available for students coming from a public school into a private school or students that start in first grade. So in other words, my older students who were in school in second or third grade when the scholarship program started are not available or not eligible for the scholarship because they were already enrolled in a private school. We had one family move in the last year from another state. Their entire family was eligible for scholarship. There was another family that came back from the mission field. Their entire family was eligible for scholarship. What that translates as is that when they get a bill, their bill is lower than what my bill is because they have more students on scholarship. It doesn't have anything to do with, well, we actually could set as a school board how much help each family gets, which is, it's designed to do that. But those are just some of the things that we're running into for scholarship. If you're paying taxes, payroll records should be saved for 3 years, and time cards, that kind of thing, should be saved for 2 years.
A question.
Yes.
If I can.
Go ahead.
If we're using payroll, which a lot of us are, instead of 1099, what, or should we be concerned about dividing the total number of hours into the teacher's wage to see if we made the minimum wage?
To make sure you're paying your teacher's minimum wage.
Correct. Because I guess I'll just say it, we aren't.
Okay.
Very small congregation, 8 families, and the number of hours that our teachers are putting in, it's not happening. So I'm left with the question, why are we pretty concerned about being on payroll if we're breaking the law there? Why not go to the 1099 and choose to break the law that way? When I was a teacher, I got paid a 1099 and appreciated it just fine. That worked great. I can argue for a 1099 as much as I can argue the other way when we're not making minimum wage.
Let me throw it back to the rest of you. Somebody with a little more experience, maybe. I'm a little fuzzy on that. I'd have to check what the regs say for sure. I understand your question. So if you're paying your teacher below minimum wage, yeah, if you need to pay a minimum wage, well, you have to decide which law you're going to break. It's kind of what I'm hearing you, what I'm hearing you say. Anyone of you have experience with that?
To that whole scenario, I have never, in my own experience, teaching whatever, a decade and a half, never had a 1099 challenge. I mean, it works, in other words.
Well, it does work. It does work.
In a small school, you probably would get challenged, the school would get challenged. You know, once you're up to 9 teachers, I'd hate to have that liability on our school, getting audited, especially if it's tied to, in our case, it's tied to church funds. And so it's more liability on the school, probably the individual.
All the comments on that predicament?
I don't know the answer to this. Does minimum wage requirements, are they, it would be a salaried position, do they apply to a salaried position?
I would think so.
Salaries, at least in Texas, salaries don't trump minimum wage rules.
The other thing I will weigh in on paying your teachers for the 1099 is that our churches, not all of our churches are promoting Social Security exemption. And as an accountant, I've had to prepare somebody's tax return who was paid a 1099 and was not Social Security exempt. And I'll tell you, it's not a pretty situation. Your teacher's left sitting on a several $1,000 tax bill because you treated him as a self-employed individual. And so that's largely why I discourage that, as well as saying, just from a standpoint of a legal standpoint, your teacher is employed, even though I do understand your predicament there.
One of the things that has been a blessing to our communities is we have a lot of young ladies teaching school I'd like to see them teach more than 1 year, but 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, and then they could do the family thing. That's wonderful. Really, that is a tremendous boost to our schools, and it actually is a community strengthener. I don't like to see teacher turnover, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing to do that BS thing. But why are we talking about minimum wage now?
Okay, that was my question. So if you want to kind of treat it as BS, can schools work like that? And then what are the requirements in relation to minimum wage if you're volunteering of sorts?
No one can prohibit you from volunteering. But I do think there are there are specifications. The government specifies fairly specifically who qualifies as a self-employed person and who does not qualify as a self-employed person. And from a penalty standpoint, if you had a teacher you paid with a 1099 and she or he decided to report the school, you'd be in some hot water because it's a fairly serious offense.
How about if a teacher would report a school for paying less than minimum wage? What are the penalties? Is a school different than a normal business, commercial operation?
If a school is under a church and is functioned as part of the church, I would think there's some difference there. There again, I have not researched a lot of those penalties. I know you're talking to an accountant, but this accountant hasn't necessarily researched all of those things. That's why I'm bouncing back to some of you who've been treasurers longer than I have. Maybe you know some of it about that. So, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that for sure.
It seems to me that we should be able to pay our teachers a little more than that. I know that we all joke with finances, being treasurers, we see those numbers. But personally, we wouldn't be willing to work for that, probably most of us.
What is minimum wage? I'm just curious. Is it 7?
It varies by state. Pennsylvania is 7.25, right?
Okay. I think Virginia's around 7 or 8 as well. Yeah.
I moved from Washington State, they just passed 15.
Really?
So you guys can throw that on your map. On your teachers put them in school. This isn't a made up. Did you say you just moved from there?
Yes.
I would have stayed.
Stayed and taught? Other questions?
Along with that line, when do you start to teach? We have teachers that spend maybe, we get there about 8 o'clock, we're normally home by 4. That's $8. And there's a teacher there that gets there 7:30 and she stays there till 6, 7 o'clock at night. So it varies from teacher to teacher, but they both do the same job. So
are you paying them by the hour or are you paying them by a salary?
Yeah.
Salary.
They're getting a lot more. Saying,
like,
it does depend on the teacher when she starts and stops, or if you're just
going to figure
school
hours. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The way we have addressed that is putting that in their job description and what the required hours are for that job, and then that's what's recorded, and then we have legal backup for that. If they choose, but we have a teacher that way too, he shows up at 6 and leaves at 8 or 9 sometimes, and you ask him, well, what's wrong? He enjoys his job. And he spends a personal time studying there too, just that's not really on the payroll.
Okay.
But if you have a set amount that you're going to figure, that should be documented and it should be in your agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious how many here use employment contracts.
How many use employment contracts? Okay, there's several of you. And by that, you're meaning signing a document saying how many hours?
It's just all that information goes in there, so there's a legal document supporting anything else that will come up.
Personally, we haven't done that. I could see some benefit to it, because I do, teachers don't always spend the amount of time there that, well, let's put it this way, maybe they're smarter than I was. But they don't spend as much time there sometimes what I used to. So anyway, you kind of wonder sometimes. Did I cut someone off? Yeah.
I cut you off. What else is in that? Or should be in our agreement or contract as you mentioned?
We'd like to have a clear job description. We reference the job description. And then the hours and the pay and commitments. If they're committed, for a year, if they're committed for 2 years, can get more paid. And then what the vacation, day policies, sick days, everything that would be in a typical.
how do you figure hours?
I don't know that I have that memorized, but the different, it goes by the job description. So some teachers, as far as how many hours for that teacher, it's based on that job description. So some of them do require more than others. So, you know, we have a high school teacher who's also working on a curriculum development project for us. So there's additional hours that he's getting paid for. So there might be another teacher who's more of a helper role. So that's going to be different teachers. Or a special ed teacher is different hours. So job description needs. I don't think what the hours are is so important, is that it's clearly understood and documented.
And just along with that, we recently implemented a policy somewhat to that extent, and it has been a help. You just have teachers, a variety of teachers, and as a teacher myself, I tried to be at school whenever school was in session. There's some teachers that, they try to be in school whenever it's in session, when it doesn't contradict anything else that they want to do. And so a job description can be helpful for that. So what do you do if a teacher takes off X number of days? How many days should a teacher be able to take off? And those are things you have to decide in your, just in your particular school, in your particular situation. Other questions? Nuts and bolts things. That's what you paid him. I would assume most of us have a policy in place for salaries and that kind of thing. Typically, you have what you call a starting salary, and then you have, the way we do it in our school is we have a starting salary, a base salary, that's adjusted for a number of years of experience. I know one school who has it, that has their salary based on, they're trying to push teacher improvement, and so they have their salary based on how many years of college that teacher has had. So the more education the teacher has had, the higher the pay scale. But we typically have a salary base, and then for our part-time teachers, we do it by the hour. So much an hour, just because they're not responsible for a classroom.
If I may comment on that question of how to pay a substitute teacher, first of all, I'll tell you this, I might be in the wrong class. I am a teacher, I'm not a administrator. I thought this would be an interesting the board might think it was a dangerous one for me to sit on. But one thing I will say about paying a substitute teacher, at my school, I get 5 days off, and there won't be any money taken away from my salary. The board will, or the school will pay the substitute so much money. There's an agreed upon price. But they don't pay them, they don't pay a substitute what they pay me. And here's something to think about. When the substitute come in, they usually come in, they teach the classes, they walk out. They might do some checking, depending on who they are. But your teacher, the actual classroom hours are just, they're just a small part of what goes into making a day. All right, your regular teacher still, even though he's gone, when he comes back, he's a bit of a lot more time in there. So your substitute teacher is not really if you compare what all goes into a day, that substitute is not really doing that much, if that makes any sense.
And then after your 5 days, then they will start docking. If you need to take more than
right.
the 5 days, they'll start docking your salary.
Now, they're paying me to come here, so they're not docking me anything. But this is something that the board was in favor of. This is considered a day of school.
And there again, it's going to depend on. In our particular situation, we have the principal actually is not at school. And so we have an agreed salary that we pay him based on the hour for the amount of time he puts into school. And so he's available as a substitute if the main teacher isn't there. And so we already have a pay scale in place for him that we plug in. I think our general policy, if the teacher would leave, we allow them one vacation day per quarter is typically how we do it. So they get about 4 days in a year. The board takes care of paying the teacher or a substitute for that day. Generally, if it were someone from the community just coming in and helping, there again, it depends who it would be. If it were a young person coming in, we'd probably pay them the per helper rate. I stepped in here a week or two ago, and they said, well, you probably get the same rate as the principal would if he stepped in. So it's going to vary depending on who steps in, that kind of thing.
Carol. So what do you do if the teachers don't use their vacation days? Do you reimburse them if they're not used, or is it use and lose?
We put in our policy that a teacher that does not use any vacation days will get a bonus. Now, ironically, the bonus we offer is less than the salary we would pay someone else to step in there. And so really, we probably need to up the bonus so, in hopes of helping the teacher stay rather than Because, frankly, they could probably leave school and go to another job and make more of that job that one day than what they would be penalized for not teaching school. So hopefully there's not teachers in that aspect. But that's kind of how we've weighed in, trying to give a benefit for not taking days. If they take more than the vacation days that they have, we will typically take their salary divided by the number of days in a calendar month. And so if, for example, they take a day off in December and there were 20 school days in December, we just divide their salary by 20 and take off that amount of money. It's typically how we do it. All right,
other questions or input? The whole teacher pay thing is an interesting, I don't know if this is the place, the budgeting workshop that I'm running tomorrow is where I'm going to talk a little more about teacher pay. But we can talk about it here as well, deciding what you're going to pay a teacher. While it's not directly a responsibility of the treasurer is the one responsible to make sure there's money there. And my understanding was that there were some years when I was teaching when the chairman or the treasurer would actually dig into his pocket to put money into the school fund so that there was money there to pay me. I didn't realize that at the time. And looking at the funds now, I say, my, really? So yeah, it's hard to know how to balance the expenditures with the income. It just is.
Question about the minimum wage. There are two points, maybe. One is there is a federal regulation that if everything is registered properly, school teachers are exempt from that law. Now, there are state laws, from what I understand, that can override that. But all that aside, my burden would be is that, why is God's people, should that even be an issue? I think if the law is what's requiring us to take care of our teachers, maybe there's some other principles amiss already. Now, that's maybe not your subject here, but just kind of cap off to that thought. But if you want to know on that code, if you want to look it up, it's the article 541.303 in the electronic code of federal regulation.
Okay. Going to make some comment about teacher salary, and I can't. Oh, I know what it was. I talked to someone. Their thought was they intentionally look for people that are willing to take less because those people are often people of higher integrity. And so if you try to get people that are willing to work for less, then you may have more of your, more coming into your school in line of the hidden curriculum. Is kind of the rationale. Which, interestingly enough, makes a little bit of sense. Like I say, I was kind of in both camps, and so I could probably argue both ways.
I think there's another thing going on in the Mennonite discussion, and that is the conservative regroupings of the 60s, they were couched in a BS mentality because of the Vietnam War. I would go home and be real vocal about this. I know that's what I would encounter. Comments like, it's good to have a BS mentality. And I personally am a little bit concerned about how, as Mennonite people today, we don't have a BS mentality. Look at how much we spend on our vehicles. If it's not at least semi-luxury, it doesn't fit our hidden curriculum, like we were hearing about. And so I don't, this is maybe getting down a rabbit trail, but I'm not sure how to evaluate these different wins. I really do feel there is a tremendous benefit in our youth putting time into a voluntary service type of situation. I mean, what if you go to tuition fees? But on the other hand, I'm with the comment that Brother Lee gave here too. If it's a church, if it's a state that has its knee in the back of the church, I'm not comfortable with that picture either. I really question where we're going to be in 20 years from now when that generation that started the conservative regroupings, when their influence is gone as it comes to the same numbers.
Well, that's my budgeting topic, but I'm willing to take it on here and give you some input on that as well, if you want to hear my opinions. I know a school. I did some interviewing in preparation to coming here. I know a school who went to an older brother in the church and said, what would it take for you to continue teaching? Need you in school? What would it take for you to continue teaching? He named them a figure, and they said, you're hired. I heard that figure, I said, how do you float that? In this particular situation, it was in excess of 50 grand a year.
Our youth can make that today. An energetic young guy can make 50 grand a year. That's not a problem. But I understand. I understand. How do you float that as a congregation?
Yeah.
What I keep grappling with, and I think the crux of this financial situation is, how can we help our members to realize that education is going to bless the church and it's going to bless the community? Because I tell you, people put money where they feel it's important. And there's been a deficit in our schools. And I don't know, I'm not here to point fingers at anybody. I look back at when I was teaching and I say, yeah, there's things I could have done better. But there seems to be a disconnect between the school and how it functions and what we see the rest of the community about. And it's just, yeah, there just seems to be a disconnect there.
Schools certainly.
Yeah, we have offerings for the school, we have offerings for everything else, all these other places need money.
Well, here's something I'd like to throw out. The thing about VS, the service and that, all that, that's great. I teach the far end of the school, so I'm teaching 7th and 8th grade or next year high school. And at the other end of the school, we have a lot of young ladies who come in and teach for 2 or 3 years. And with that constant teacher turnover, I am very limited in my classroom. I am teaching and drilling things and trying to reinforce things that should have been taken care of in 3rd and 4th grade. When do you use T-H-E-I-R or when do you use T-H-E-R-E in Sealy curriculum, Rebecca, and good curriculum, but it's our hidden curriculum is not that great, and it's partly because of that turnover rate. And now, at our school, I signed a 5-year contract, and we have businessmen who said that, who told the school that if you can get men teachers in there, we will step up and we will make it possible. So there's two of us there. But at the other end, there would be teachers that we could hire, single ladies who have experience or they're maybe 30, 40 years old or whatever. They would have a heart for it, but we would have to pay them more. But it's easier to sort of hire these younger sisters who are willing to work for 2 or 3 years. So while VS is good, I applaud the idea that our young people serve, I'm not sure that school is always the best place where they should be serving. The other thing, we heard about Wisconsin versus Yoder this morning. Well, there's another court case, the Peyote case, where the doctrine that the Supreme Court used to determine Wisconsin versus Yoder, the doctrine that determined the outcome of that has changed. And so today we are, it's our having schools the way we do is not so much a right as it is the government's benevolence. And so we really, really need to think about being above reproach. We need to think about having a more excellent education, because it's not only minimum wage, some of those laws that we're violating, but it's also, at least in the state of Ohio, the people we hire don't fit the criteria that the state expects. And so the more things that we do better, the better it will be for us if there ever is a day of reckoning. Does that make sense? So for you all, if you are working in your, now I teach at a community school, so it's not a church school, but you might be in a position where you can sort of put that out a little bit, and you know, you're. I have served on. Well, I've been a teacher at one school, and I've been on the board at another school, so I have seen both sides as well. If you can talk to people about the businesses in the community, say, hey, look, this is important. This is. School is really the it's not just the future of our church, but it's the future of how our businesses are going to interact with the people around us. Our businesses are, that's our outreach to the people right around us. And we need good teachers there. We need to pay. Because if you're going to have somebody in there long term, if you're going to have somebody in there who's going to really be there to give it everything he can or she can for a long period of time, you just have to pay. For a long time, I thought that, this is voluntary, this is good, but it's not good for a marriage. And we're tired for my children. And thankfully, we're in a place now where I think we're at the sort of a place where you mentioned with that as well. And I'm very grateful.
Somebody want to push back on that?
I have mixed feelings about the voluntary service issue with school. I guess it bothers me a little bit when we have a burden for our teachers, our young folks to do voluntary service when that benefits me. In other words, as a, you know, the school is God's work. Amen. But if that young person serves our school for very cheap or free or whatever, that's benefiting me because it's me as a working adult that is supporting that school. So my burden for them to do voluntary service, I guess I feel like my burden for them to do voluntary service should be something that isn't directly affecting my pocketbook. How much do we value it?
The voluntary service idea. The one thing to think about is to not have all the staff being kind of in the middle, minimum wage below, but to actually pay the long term and the key staff a little wage, whatever you want to call it. That's a real thing. You're actually going to have voluntary service position. You can call it that, name it that, everybody knows it's that. The person that goes into that goes in and serves, everybody knows, the students know, everybody knows this person is serving 1 year, or just, you know, like we have people do, they're providing something. So there's a distinct difference. And then when that term is up, they do something else, or they might actually be employed with them. If you're going to be VS, call that. Not done.
The reason we don't do that for the certificate is because we want to have our cake and we want to eat it too. In other words, we don't want a BS product. You know how building projects go when it's all BS labor. I mean, there's time for that. There it is. You know, but if you're a builder and you know how BS labor projects go, we don't want those results. They're our children after all. They're our heritage of the Lord and long we go. You know, we want this high stuff. But we want other people to pay the price for it. That was a strong statement, but I'm afraid that's the truth.
Well, I wouldn't say it's not. Because when the school bills come out, I have a fairly acute, fairly acute interest in where what the figure is.
I have another question along maybe a slightly different line, but in your communities, are you giving a receipt for tax charitable donations for the school? Like some congregations, probably especially smaller congregations, there's offerings. You mentioned offerings for the school. For tax purposes. Is that legal? Because you're getting service in return?
The take that we've taken on that is that it is deductible if it's given to the church.
not because it's given to the church, but because there is an in-between between you and who is getting the money. So legally, if you give a direct gift to someone, it is not deductible. So if you want to give me a gift, you can't write it off in your taxes and say, this is deductible. If you give it to an organization and the organization has control over where that money goes, then it is deductible. And as a charitable organization, your donation to the church is deductible. Now, having said that, there are schools who function solely on donations, and I don't have any problem with that. It's a blessing. The question that you need to ask, though, is, so if a family from the community wants to send their children to your school, you're not going to charge them anything? In other words, you're going to tell them, well, just put it in the offering, whatever you need to. Well, really. So, yeah, there's my argument. Legally, I think you need to, it's good to have some kind of policy in place where you're paying a certain amount that is not deductible because you're paying it for education. And offerings can work for that as well. But in terms of legal, is it legal to deduct it? Yes, in the sense that the church is deciding where the funds go. Now, really, what I've thought about to really be above board, what probably should happen, is you would take your offerings for the month and then distribute those offerings to these different places based on, so rather than saying the offering for this Sunday is for this particular thing, is it legal? Yes, in the sense you're giving to the church, but
it happened in our school probably 7 or 8 years ago. Someone got audited, and it didn't work with the auditor. The IRS guys came out and said, we can't do it.
The donation to the church?
The donation to the school. They said, you're sending your children to this school, and you're getting benefit from this, so you can't count it as deductible. There has to be some nominal tuition amount.
I see.
Okay. It's not legal, and they may pay a fine.
I hadn't heard about that. I'm not surprised.
Was the money coming in through the general fund and then over or through a school fund on the church books?
All the total donations to the school. That were being counted as deductible.
So the.
And then we moved to a tuition after that.
So that it's a gray zone anyway, kind of. But we've been very meticulous about insisting our school budget comes out of our general fund. So we're a church-run school, so all the money for the school comes through the general fund, and then the church has its discretion to use that general fund for wherever they want to. The school then charges the church X amount per student for running the school, and if it's a non-member family, they pay that same amount.
Okay.
There's a little technicality there that we don't know if it was standing court, but we feel like we would have a chance per our legal counsel.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have any offering earmarked school off?
Very intentionally not.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're able to explain that again, so the school charges the church.
Our budget is per student, and we get twice a month, however many students we get X amount. So the church is paying us to educate their children.
In our particular situation, and probably in some of the schools, you would have a member tuition and a non-member tuition. Does that ring any bells? In other words, that's the way we would operate. Someone from the community sending their children would have a little different tuition rate than someone that's part of the church, based on the fact that it's a church-owned school, and also that the church members would be expected to put into the offering.
If I may ask, how much do you charge non-members?
Our school fund is a, our school budget is a work in progress. We started out as an outreach. The sending congregation helps to fund the school, and so we're just about in the first year or so having to fund it totally ourselves. Actually, maybe we're coming up on that. Right now we're at between $3,000 and $3,500, I think, for a non-member tuition.
We do 3,000, but then we also have school tuition for members and children. So much per child, I believe it's $400 a child, and then $400 per member.
Okay.
As well.
Okay.
Then I was wondering, how does that work into the offering? We also take offerings. Would you, if you have school tuition, would you be allowed to count the offering as a deductible or not? You mean a family?
The key is what he said earlier, is if that is coming through a general fund. If you have any strings attached to say where it goes, which is a big problem, and I serve as deacon, so I've had to educate myself on that. Any money that would come through is conduit funds. If a donor gives money and says, give this to brother so-and-so to help with that hospital bill, I can't give a tax deductible receipt for that. If he donates it to the Brotherhood Aid Fund, and he has no control of where that goes, and the church says where it goes, then I can give him a tax. So that's the core principle that has to stay true throughout.
Yeah, the core principle we're looking at is the principle of control. Okay. Who has control of the money? And in our particular situation, I don't know if it would stand in court to where I'm a little uneasy about it, but we have a school offering. The offering goes into the church fund and is transferred into the school fund. So the church has control. However, when we say it's a school offering, do I expect the church to not funnel it there? Well, no. So whether it was standing court or not, I'm not 100% sure.
I'd like to add, about 3 years ago, our church went to strictly no designated offering. You just have general offerings, and then we develop a budget once a year, what goes into maintenance fees of the church, what goes to the school, what goes to missions, and it has really worked well. One of the things that we like about it is if you ever miss the Sunday, maybe when it's school offering, that's no longer an issue. You just give checks. If you miss a Sunday, you make it up, and it goes into that fund. And the budget thing has very well worked for us, so that the church then decides how much is going to go to schools and how much goes to that. We like it very well.
That would be a situation I would promote as an accountant, because there you certainly have the control figure in place, and I think that would stand up. That would have a much better chance of standing up under an audit. Thank you. Okay, anyone else want to feed into any of this?
Thank you. That was some very interesting discussion. I'm also a treasurer for the church and school.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.